This is Studio 360, live at the Aspen Ideas Festival. I'm Kurt Anderson. My next guest has spent his scholarly career figuring out how we think and create. He is a Harvard professor of education and psychology and a MacArthur genius, and best known for his theory of multiple intelligences. Dr. Howard Gardner, welcome. Now, I think your most recent book is about how we change our minds, our own minds and those of other people. What do you mean when you say changing minds? The fact that I changed the shirt I was going to wear tonight, does that count or not?
Well, literally, of course, it counts, Kurt, but I'm interested in big changes of mind. For example, Einstein changed our sense of time and space. Picasso, people after Picasso painted, never painted the same. So I'm interested also in what happened after Darwin put out the theory of evolution. It changed, sooner or later, the minds of all scientists about the origins of life and the origins of species.
What is the last time that you, Howard Gardner, significantly changed your mind about something?
Well, when I think about my own life, probably the recent mind change was whether I would stop mostly doing research as an observer and become more of an activist. That was very, very hard for me. Scholars like to look at things and think about them and write about them, and we don't often like to stand in the fore. But in my life, both in terms of speaking out on issues and becoming more involved in actually trying to put some of my ideas into action by working with young people in high school and college, this is a really major mind change and a major action change. Whether that happened because I reached a certain age and got gutsier, or because I felt that having developed certain ideas, I had an obligation to put them into action, my psychiatrist would have to tell you that.
Well, we have him on the phone, Howard. No. But we have gone to the audience and asked them for some stories about times they changed their minds. And we are first going to John at table four to get his story.
Hi, Kurt.
Hello.
How are you?
Good.
My name is John. I live here in Aspen, Colorado. I manage a supermarket here in town. And probably my life-changing experience is I was a confirmed bachelor for 47 years. Never had any intentions of marrying, and I met a charming lady from Brazil by the salad bar in the city market. And we met, and the first time that I met, that I went out with her, I fell in love with her, and which I thought was real unusual because I had no intentions of ever getting married. And we married a year later, and we've subsequently gone to Brazil numerous times, and I fell in love with Brazil also. And Brazil is completely different from Aspen, a completely different culture.
So I understand.
Yeah.
Dr. Gardner, what do you make of that mind change? That's a serious commitment to one paradigm in John's life.
Well, you actually fell in love with somebody who had a very different background from you. And one of the questions I'd ask you, John, is had you gone out before with somebody who also came from a very, very different kind of background?
I'd spent some time in the Honduras, and I'd had a girlfriend down there in the Honduras, but marriage was not part of what our relationship was about.
Okay, well, this is very interesting to me. I'm not that kind of a psychiatrist, but you've had an interest in what we might say relatively exotic partners, but at a certain point, you decided that you wanted to convert this into marriage. Did you have a feeling that maybe this was your last chance?
Well, no, not at all.
Well, let's hope it was. Congratulations.
It is now, yes.
Great. We now have a question, or a life-changing, mind-changing story from Rebecca at table 31.
Hi, my name is Rebecca. I'm from Chicago, and my whole life I was a social drinker. I enjoyed drinking. When I turned 43, I realized that was the age at which my mother had become an alcoholic, and I decided to stop drinking so that I wouldn't have to worry about becoming an alcoholic myself.
It's a very brave way for you to talk about this, because I'm sure it wasn't very easy. Do you actually remember, did this come at one instant, or did you realize 43 was coming? How sudden was this this realization, and then how difficult was it for you to actually carry through? Because you can decide to stop drinking, but we know it doesn't necessarily follow that you're going to be successful.
Right. It was actually pretty pretty sudden. I did the math. I realized that when I was 8, I became very aware that my mother, you know, really started drinking heavily, and she had me when she was 35, and I don't, you know, I just did the math and realized I was the same age. And when I realized that, I actually, it was very easy. I just quit and have not regretted it. Feel much better.
Thank you. Two comments. It's interesting that for both of the first two people, for John and Rebecca, and I don't know them, this is what we would call a midlife kind of insight.
That's because everyone here is pretty old.
But let me talk now about what you did, we might call, in the language of psychology, little c, creativity. You did something which was a transformation of mind and behavior. But as many people know, 50, 60 years ago, there was someone, I believe he was called Dr. Bob, who himself underwent a change, stopped drinking, but then he created Alcoholics Anonymous. And that, I would say, would be a big C, creativity, because he transformed the minds and the behavior of thousands, perhaps millions of people. And this is a very important thing that I'd like to bring out, is that many of us have those transformations of mind which are very important for us, but where we might be somewhat different from an architect like Frank Gehry or Frank Lloyd Wright, is to take the individual mind change and then to paint it on a very wide scale. And if you do it well, Walter Isaacson will write a book about you.
If you're beloved enough. He only writes about beloved people. Have you ever noticed that?
Well, it's hard to write about someone if you find that you increasingly dislike them. That's what happened with Lawrence Thompson's book about Robert Frost. And he just didn't like him, and it was very hard to finish. So,
he changed his mind about
Robert
Frost.
Absolutely, right.
Imagine the road not taken there.
I just have to interrupt. I was not going to intrude, but I changed my mind. And I'm here because my name is Miss Lady. I have a question for you, both of you. And this is my first time here in Aspen. And I don't mind telling you, I'm from Chicago. I live on the street, so I am not your typical Aspen woman by any stretch. Let's just say that my budget for essentials like highlights and microdermabrasion has to take a backseat to my other essentials like 50-cent hot dogs. So, yes, clearly I would not fit in here long term, but it is a nice place to visit. Now, I do want to say that it feels very strange to me to be homeless in a place where some folks are depressed because they are second and third homeless. Now, think about that now. That's right. So my question to you is, with some of us living such a disparate, there's a word for y'all, that's a good Aspen Idea Festival type of vocabulary word. With some of us living such disparate reality, how do we bridge the gap, not just globally, but here at home, between the haves, the have-nots, and have you lost your mind? That's more money than anybody can spend. That's what I want to know.
I guess Miss Lady would say, forget changing minds. She thinks y'all have lost your mind.
Sarah, you know, I'm a professor, and if you ask me, I could profess for the next 3 weeks. I'm also a writer, and if you said to me, sit down and write, I could do it without any difficulty. But even if I lived to be 969 years of age, I would have no idea about what you do and how you do it. So tell us a bit, how does Sarah Jones manage to create convincingly these disparate, if not desperate, characters?
Right, both, right. I think that they come from what I hope is a deep well of empathy. And I've had a conversation about this with others who I admire who do this kind of work. I love Anna Deavere Smith. Meryl Streep has been a big mentor of mine and a presence in my life. And she says that acting is listening, and I know others have it. And for me, acting is also, ability to sort of think of another person's lot as your own for however long. And I guess I can imagine myself
as this person very easily, because there but for the grace of God, you know, even with or without the schmata,
you know. And
I also, you know, very much, I have, I think, somewhere beating in my heart, a lovely octogenarian Jewish woman. What can I tell you?
So I think that, and it's not just older people, it's younger people. I identify with people very deeply, and that makes me committed to trying to capture the reality of who they are physically, vocally, emotionally.
One of the things I wondered was the extent to which when you were in school, Sarah, were you already doing this sort of thing? Were you already shadowing people and trying to hear them?
Well, it's an excellent question, and you've earned all of your accolades in just this one second, because I went to the United Nations school, and I was surrounded by kids from lots of different backgrounds. I had already grown up in a multicultural family, and I think from childhood, I mean, I actually used to get in, well, I didn't get in big trouble, but I used to call the school nurse back before we had cell phones as my friend's parents and get us out of class so that we could go play hooky. So I remember learning out of necessity the ability to talk like this, to say, listen, my daughter, she's very ill today. Make sure that she is bundled up very carefully. Put her in the car park because I'm coming to pick her up. It's very important. And then we would all go off and play hooky all day.
That's terrible, but it's true.
She gives new meaning to multiple intelligences, I
yes,
guess.
Absolutely. So you're saying that one ingredient is empathy. Another one, though, is being surrounded by other people, very, very different kinds of people. And then you began to do some kind of experimenting, and I would guess that at a certain point you realized you were good at it, right?
Good enough to get into trouble. Yeah.
The reason I ask about school is our usual notion of intelligence is people who are good in language and good in logic. And it's clear you're very good in language. We haven't established your logic. But one of the things we find out is people can be creative in very different kinds of intelligences. We're on radio, but those of us who are here can see that you have a lot of bodily intelligence. And you don't just project the voice, but you also put in an appearance, you hold yourself. And that's a very important part of what you do. As a professor, I just sort of stand there. It's not necessary for me to have any kind of bodily intelligence. Also, while you're using language, you're also using it musically, and especially when you're trying to imitate the rhythms and the textures of Jewish or whatever the group is. So I would say there's some musical intelligence, probably the most important intelligence, which we now realize is so important in life but not in school, is personal intelligence, which means both understanding other people and understanding yourself. I don't know what kind of self-understanding you have, but clearly you have a deep understanding of other people. And I would imagine you use the audience to help you see which aspects of the other people are most easily transmitted. But since we're talking about changing minds, can you remember at which point you stopped being a student and began to transmogrify into a performer whose potential seems to me to be unlimited?
Well, thank you. My agent, ladies and gentlemen. I think that I was writing the voices of these people. That was really the sort of the turning point. I began to not only observe them, but to sort of try to slip into some window onto their consciousness and just sort of sit there and think as they might think and try to write as they might write. And I started writing poems, some very bad poems, but I started writing whatever I thought might really reflect accurately their experience, which required me to read a lot more and talk to, you know, friends about their experiences if I hadn't grown up with exactly that experience. But I began to write as these people, and that sort of freed my voice as a writer. And I think...
Was there a moment where you sort of came out to your family and said, I'm not going to be a lawyer, a doctor, even a writer, I'm going on stage?
Yes, and it also sounded something like, Mom, I'm leaving Bryn Mawr, and I'm going home to, you know, experiment at poetry cafes on open mic night. Hope that's all right with you. I plan to pay my bills
that
way.
Can you imitate what she said?
Sarah, wait a minute. Are you coming home now? Okay, let's talk about this. Let's talk about this. I don't want to hem you in, but let's think about this. Let's talk about this. Now, my mother, I should say, is a clinician. She's an OBGYN, and so the very idea that I not only didn't go into medicine, I didn't become a professional, you know, I was sort of going to be birthing imaginary people for not a very good living. You know, I'm sure that scared her terribly. But
no malpractice issues.
No malpractice issues, no insurance, no HMOs. I think I came out ahead.
Howard, obviously, Sarah does, in addition to her many talents, as you suggested, she represents what you call these various intelligences. Do people, especially say, people in a place like the Aspen Ideas Festival, where they all have 800 SATs and high IQs, ever accuse you of misusing the word intelligence to apply to these other things to sort of make people without 800 SATs feel better?
Absolutely. And I always say, fine to call it a talent if you call being good with words or good with music a talent. What I object to is taking two of them, language and logic, putting them on a pedestal and neglecting everything else. But let me tell you a story about that. I once wrote an op-ed for the New York Times in which I said that I thought the SAT should be untimed. And that's because there are very few things in life where timing is that important. As long as you can get the answers right, it's fine. I've never had an experience like this. I sat at my computer and I heard one ding after another of people writing back, but it was about half and half. Half the people agreed with me, the other half that didn't. Do you know who disagreed the most? People for whom having their high SAT was the most important thing they ever achieved in their life. But, of course, Aspen is not composed of people like that. It's composed of people with multiple talents, and they could all go and do exactly what Rashid and Miss Lady did without any rehearsal whatsoever.
Dr. Howard Gardner, thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Howard Gardner is a professor of psychology at Harvard. If any of you out there have a good story about a time that you really changed your mind, tell us about it. Leave a comment at studio360.org. Coming up, more characters from the endlessly talented Sarah Jones and live music from folk rock renegade legend Steve Earle. That is just ahead in Studio 360 from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Stay with us.